I think that I've only ever heard Child Protective Services mentioned in a scary context, like CPS is coming to take your kids. So when my expert today reached out to me, I couldn't wait to get the real scoop. Welcome to the Just Dumb Enough podcast, a show that acknowledges no one is always an expert by dispelling misconceptions with real experts. I'm your host as always, Colton Petrie. My guest today is Lance Hilsinger. Lance retired after 34 years in child welfare. He's here to break down what child welfare does, what they don't do, and ways the system could improve. There are certainly some very interesting bits tucked away in this brief interview, like this one.
There's a history of that back in the 50s, a couple of hundred children were taken from Indian homes, not because of abuse or neglect.
Let's foster better homes. Welcome to the show, Lance Hilsinger.
Thank you for having me, Cole.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here, Lance. I'm very excited to talk to you today. Why don't you introduce yourself a little bit for the audience?
My name's Lance Hilsinger, and I'm a retired child welfare social worker. I worked 34 years in child welfare, the first 5 years with Los Angeles County and the other years with San Luis Obispo County. Geographically, San Luis Obispo is just north of Santa Barbara County. All but the first year, I handled court cases of one type or another. For most of my career, I handled what we call dependency court cases, the initial court hearings, where the child is declared dependent or the case is dismissed. And then once the child is declared a dependent, then usually, typically, you have another worker, what we call a family relocation, family maintenance worker assigned, and then you have a change of workers at that point. So I did that for the last several years of my career.
Very interesting. What kind of got you into this career field to start with?
Well, it's a good story, I think. I had gotten a master's from Vanderbilt University. I have my bachelor's in psychology and political science from UCLA. I returned back to California, got a job working with people with dual diagnosis, developmental disabilities, and a mental health diagnosis. And we were taking these, they were all young adults, mostly men. And I worked with a partner. And a person I didn't particularly like. And the person said, well, why don't we see if we can get Dale, who was one of the guys in the group, see if we can get him a job as a dishwasher at county cafeteria. And because I was primed to not like this person's idea, I almost said, oh, that's a stupid, no, that is a good idea. That sounds like a good idea. That sounds like a very good idea. So we made a little field trip down, and this is the pre-internet days. So we made a trip down to the Hall of Administration in downtown Los Angeles, looking before this huge book of jobs that the county offered. Child welfare, children's services worker, was that what was called at that time. Children's workers were came in the alphabet before dishwasher. And I said, hey, this is a job for myself. And so I applied and got the job.
Nice. Just kind of wandered into that one, huh?
So yeah, just kind of wandered into it. And I always think of that story when I'm having difficulty with somebody. You got to remember that they might help you out. They might have something that's good for your life.
So, you know, we talk about like child welfare. Is this all kind of the, what people call like the CPS umbrella?
Yes. CPS and child welfare are pretty much interchangeable. The child welfare kind of is a more global thing, not just the immediate protection of the child, but long-term, what's the best interest. And child protection is just that immediate police going out kind of thing. Yes.
So is there usually like, you know, some most common reasons that CPS or child welfare would get involved in a case to start with?
Well, I think we make a big distinction between cases and investigations, or what we call referrals. So someone calls the hotline, if it rises to the merit of investigating, sometimes people just call, my neighbor's yelling at their kids, but there's no abuse or neglect, yeah, you know, alleged. If it's deemed enough to investigate, and you investigate, sometimes it's, you can't substantiate anything. If a person calls Monday morning and says, last night my neighbors were on meth, well, maybe you show up Monday morning, everybody's cold sober, you can't prove one way or the other. So there's things that can be dismissed as unsubstantiated or unconfirmed, but the thing is sustained allegations. There's the states use different terms. California uses the three types CERN where it's sustained, or you can't prove it either way, or it's it just didn't happen because it's a physical impossibility. You just are sure it didn't happen. If it's very serious, then the situation and where the child has to be removed, then you have a court case. And that's what I did for all but the first year. The first year I was an emergency response worker, the person going out when a call comes into the hotline.
Does it usually come down to is there a most common reason that you get called, or is it pretty spread out?
I tell people that of court cases, because that's what I did, roughly 2/3 of the court cases are substance abuse of one form or another. Maybe substance abuse and domestic violence, substance abuse, physical abuse, something like that. But roughly 2/3 of them substance abuse and neglect.
So when does that kind of, differentiate between okay, we've gotten this call and someone has to go investigate now?
Mm-hmm. So we investigate. Sometimes the social worker will go and investigate. If it's a general neglect, a dirty home kind of thing, the social worker will go out on their own. If it's something where someone is very volatile and there's really concern that there's something very serious, then we ask for the police to come and we go out jointly. Other times the police have arrested somebody and the children have no place to go and we're responding to the police. So it can either one of the any one of those scenarios is possible. In Florida, all the cases are, unless that's changed, go out with a police officer. And that's a little intimidating. I don't think that people are going to be, they're going to be more candid with a casually dressed social worker, and they're going to say, I lost control, or I they're going to be, but then a police officer, they're going to climb up. So I don't think that's a good process. But like I said, each state does things a little bit differently. And of course, each county within each state does differently.
Well, and that's, it's very different. I get where they're coming from, because it sounds like it could be physically dangerous, right? You're showing up to a place where they're like, this person's very abusive. And it's like, well, I mean, if they abuse their kid, what's the chance they'll abuse me? But also,
there have been instances like that, those things, but they're fortunately very rare. As I wrote in my book, I was only really threatened once, and that happened at a courthouse and so it wasn't out at someone's home. So there's been times that people got mad, but you kind of learn to be, always make sure the door is to your back so that if you can leave, if you have to.
I mean, do you run into other legal blockages along the way? Like you get called out to a place for abuse and neglect or whatever it might be, and you can't even get in the door because they're like, no, you can't come in.
Yeah, that can happen. And you do as a, and again, I didn't do that emergency response very often, but people do that. You'd be surprised how often people will let you in. You can say, well, we could talk here at the door, but your neighbors are going to see us. You've got a county car parked there. Oh, okay. If necessary, you can get a warrant. People talk about, CPS did this without a warrant. You can get a warrant if you have probable cause.
Is that fairly difficult and time consuming, or is it pretty easy to get one?
Actually, we don't need to do it that often. Time consuming, yes. It's time consuming. And a particular bugaboo that I had about in San Luis Obispo County is you'd write up the warrant, you'd write up the paperwork that you need to, go to the judge, get sworn in, and then you'd have to physically drive to the sheriff's department, which is 7 miles away, and get the warrant into the system. And then you go out to the home. And this is extremely time-consuming process. And I've got to think that other counties have got to do it better. And that's one of the things, because it deadlines, if there was a warrant situation, and it made it very, very difficult to write a report. The timelines were just very, very tight. They're tight anyways. But if you've got a case that involves a warrant, I just think that you it's like if you're in court the next day, you have to be out investigating the case and being placing the kid if that's what's happening. And then also write a report. It's a very poor system to do that. I think that, like I said, there's got to be improvement with our local system here.
Well, and I can imagine that being very stressful, because much like every job, I have to assume child welfare also does not have a wealth of employees that are, sitting on their hands at all times. Like you've got to be pretty busy all the time.
Yeah. Well, the phone always rings. We don't have to, there's this conspiracy theories out there that somehow we're off looking for children and things like that. No, we have plenty of work. We have plenty of work. Yes. Maybe I could walk you through the system a little bit and how the court process works.
Yeah, I'd love to.
So again, if call comes into the hotline, statistically, less than 1 in 1,000 calls result in a termination of parental rights. So if you're going out trying to take people's kids, as these people allege, that's a very inefficient way. And like I said, most cases are investigated, and you can have say, okay, we can't substantiate this. This is not substantiated. We just don't know. Other times you come up with somebody who says, yeah, my life is, you know, think I got a lot of chaos in my life. I recognize that. And we people work with people informally. So you have we have cases that are not court cases. And I think that doesn't get enough attention out there, that there's people that we work with without them. And sometimes it's very successful. Sometimes, of course, it's not, but we try to. And then there's another path called the non-detained petition, where you say, this person wants to work with us, but it's so serious, Judge, that we want to go to court and have the court process there to help it. And that's a non-detained petition. But most of the majority of the time, when a kid comes into foster care, it's something to where the child's been placed in protective custody at the moment because the parents are being arrested and something has happened at that moment that's triggered the child's placement. Yeah. And then you have a detention hearing. You have to file the petition within 2 days, and the next business day is the detention hearing, which is we equivalent in criminal court of an arraignment hearing. The child can go home at the detention hearing. The child can go home at any hearing. The next hearing is called the jurisdictional hearing, which is what are the facts? And then the dispositional hearing is what are we going to do? Now, in practice, those two hearings are often combined. But if there's real felony charges pending, the parents can opt to say, oh, we just want a jurisdiction hearing at this point. That's about the only time that happens.
So in these, you know, 0.1% of cases where they do lose parental rights, is that kind of when, you know, all children go into foster care?
Well, children go into foster care right at that moment. And then you have, after the dispositional hearing, you'll have, assuming at any point the child has not gone home, you have a 6-month review hearing, then a 12-month review hearing, and then an 18-month review hearing. Normally in most cases, that's the exhausted. At the 12-month is the usual mark in California. You can get an extension to 18 months and a rare occasions now to 24 months. But if the parent has exhausted that, and after that period, we don't want kids' language in foster care, then it's referred for adoptive planning if that's a viable plan. Sometimes you may have a kid who's 14 and says, I don't want to be adopted by anybody. There's nobody. So you have kids who are graduate from foster care. And then those kids, if you're a teen in foster care, and then you become 18, the system used to be, okay, good luck. We'll be with you to graduate high school or turn 18, whichever is last, but that's it. Now in most states, they have extended foster care. And as long as the youth is in a job or attending school or a combination of the two, they can remain a dependent in court. They can get a supplemental amount. They can get their foster care payment directly, and then we can help them until they're 21.
And then, I mean, how did you, from your perspective, did you see a lot of like foster care families? Was there a lot of them, or was it kind of a struggle to place people sometimes?
Well, it's one of the things I point out in my book is that when I started with San Luis Obispo County, we had 15 emergency beds, 15 places where we could take kids on an emergency basis, because a lot of people are foster parents, but they don't want to be, they get the call at 2 o'clock in the morning. So there's like two types of foster homes. There's like the regular longer term foster homes and the people who are, it's a poor, horrible term. It's called shelter care. It sounds like you're putting kids in some sort of like Red Cross emergency shelter. The shelter care homes are just like middle-class homes that blend into the neighborhood, but that's the term the bureaucrats use. So those are shelter care, foster care parents, who are kind of like designated, okay, we're going to care for the child for a short period of time until the child is placed somewhere more permanent. Roughly just over half of placements are with relatives. So that's the preferred placement. We prefer the family. Like I said, we had 15 of these beds, including 6 that were in a group home for kids, for juveniles that we shared with the probation department. When I left, we only had 9. Shelter beds. And in those interviewing years, the population of the county increased by about 50%. Wow. So very often we would get an email, okay, there's only 1 shelter care home vacancy. We would get an email every work business day, how many beds were available in shelter care. And occasionally it would be said there aren't any. And so that's a chilling system. And that's very, very stressful to work under. And of course, when COVID hit, that made foster parent recruiting that much more difficult. People don't want to bring a child who might have COVID into their own home. And then a lot of in-person kind of stuff that needs to be done. So that was very challenging.
What happens if there are zero beds and you need a place?
We usually find something. We'll call somebody who's, you know, a regular, for lack of a better word, or someone, one of those persons who we only want to care for kids long-term, but we call them anyways. Hey, I got a short-term situation, you know.
Gotcha.
And I called one case I had, the people, yeah, that's what happened. And they said, yeah, after this, we're done. We don't want to be taking this. So, and foster parents is, I've read somewhere that like it's 20% turnover. Now, imagine you're building a car and, you know, you got a vendor that's going to provide your tires. You got a vendor that provides your brakes. You got a vendor that provides your carburetor. Imagine changing your vendors, 20% of your vendors every year. That would be very difficult to build a car, right? We're basically needing 20% turnover there recruiting. So it's very, one of the reasons I wrote my book was to encourage people to be foster parents. People say, oh, the system doesn't work. So the one thing that will make the system work better is more foster homes, because we're kind of spread out in San Luis Obispo County. We're kind of rural. So, you know, if I have to drive 30, 40 minutes in one direction for a foster home, and then the next kid I see in a foster home is an hour to the other side of the county, that just doesn't work. You know, that's very inefficient. But if we have foster homes closer to where the child is, so maybe they can even continue their same school, that kind of thing. It just, that's the one thing that's really needed in the system.
How far away can you transport a child for foster care?
Well, we normally look to our own county. So we have our own county foster homes. We have contracts. In San Luis Obispo, it's a contract with Family Care Network that they provide their foster homes. If it's a relative, we could, you know, we'll transport to the relative, obviously. And if it's another state, that's a whole separate rules. So you have to ask, you have to request the other state to do an investigation, and that has to come back. And it's a very, very bureaucratic thing to place a child in another state. But anywhere in the county, we look, of course, locally first. Sometimes kids have very severe mental health needs, behavioral needs, and you need them to be placed in a specialized program. And that I've driven all across, I've been in both sides of the direction of in California on overnight trips where kids were placed. That was when I was doing longer term after I was a court worker. Yeah.
Well, and we kind of talked about, you know, you'd like to place them with family, ideally. Do you still consider it foster care when it's like a relative?
Yes, yes. The foster, in fact, there's a court case way back that's now 30, 40 years old that says that the relative is to get paid as a foster parent.
So what does it take to become, like, if you want to join the foster care system, you're like, I want to be part of the solution?
Well, I just tell people to Google foster parent, whatever county they happen to be in. And that's usually in California, child welfare is administered at the county level. In most states, it's administered at the state level. So the social worker is a state employee. So you might have to call, you know, Tennessee Foster Care Association, and then you just call them up. Each state does things differently, but there's, of course, there's an inspection of the home, there's a background checks, that kind of thing. There's some classes to attend, but that's how to do it.
And you'd said, like, foster care families get paid to do this?
Well, yeah, I mean, kids are expensive.
Yeah.
Kids are expensive. And California hadn't raised the foster care reimbursement rate for quite a while. And people we were having to place kids in group homes or specialized situations and that were more expensive. Funnily, hey, we're going to save money if we actually pay foster parents to care for the kids. And this is one of the things that I kind of point out, that a shelter care parent may care for several different kids during a calendar year, but they can't claim that child as a dependent. A foster parent who cares a child for more than 6 months can claim that child as a dependent, because you're providing for the child care. You're taking the child to school, you're feeding, all the clothing, all that stuff, all the things you would expect a parent to do, that costs money. You know, if you want to roll a child in sports, that's money. If you want to do this or that, you know, you're going to, you know, so it's necessary. And I point that out because I had a case where the birth mother claimed the child, and both the foster mother and birth mother both claimed the child as a dependent in the taxes.
Is it the kind of thing where it's like that pay would be very supplemental, like you should still you have your regular job and everything else,
Oh,
or is
absolutely.
okay.
Yeah, it's not considered pay, it's considered reimbursement. So it's
Gotcha.
not taxed. And that's one of the things that if you have a child that's needs very often foster kids need therapy or they need some specialized medical appointments, or you're talking with teachers more, you're doing much more than the normal parenting duties, that can conflict with work. So it's ideally somebody who has a flexible schedule.
And is this kind of like, I know obviously your experience is right here in the US. Do you know if this is like a global thing, like other countries kind of have systems like this, or are we fairly unique?
Our system is unique. I'm not really authority on other systems. Canada's system is similar to the United States. The termination of parental rights in other countries, it's my understanding, is only one that happens when the parent agrees to do it. To do it against the parent's will is more difficult in other countries. And in England, I looked into it a little because I was thinking, maybe I'll go to England and be a social worker for a little bit. They have a very interesting work. There's a lot of local authorities. And they have very similar to our county system. Each county is very different. There, though, the children are 16. So if a kid is 17 and a half and runs away from foster care, we still, that's the runaway. We do all the missing persons reports, all that stuff that you're supposed to do. In England, 16, your kid runs away from foster home. That's considered a child's right kind of thing.
I mean, I think I was thinking of like, old movies where they're like, "Welcome to the orphanage. This is how we handle all of our, lost or missing or whatever children. We just kind of throw them into one giant building." And I was like, "Well, that can't be. Obviously, it's not a US thing anymore, but is that still a thing otherwise?"
Well, two things about that. One is the Beatles song "Penny Lane." That's what it refers to, the child's home. And then back many years, there was children going into homes and orphanages. Kind of the classic thing in Russia, and Americans were adopting these children. But I read that as long as some relative made a contact within 6 months, the child could not be adopted. And then our politics with Russia soured real bad, and so that's no longer happening. There are international adoptions. There are international adoption agencies. China, a lot of kids are adopted from China.
Yeah, I understand it's not terribly uncommon to adopt from outside the country. I just know there's some red tape involved.
Yeah, and it would be, I hope everyone will be patriotic because we certainly need adoptive families here. And there's nice ads running now. I don't know if you've seen them about adopting teens. Because when the people are looking for that baby often, and it's usually no, you have to give the parents a chance, except for what has happened roughly about 10, 15 years ago. California said, here's a list of things that are really so bad, we're not going to give the parent a second chance. Or we still give the option to give a second chance, but the judge has to make a special finding. And that's good because that makes things real clear. So, okay, you have brutalized a child under the age of five, you're going to just kind of go to the path of not giving you a chance to get your kid back. One of the most common ways is if you have already lost a child and you were unsuccessful in getting that child back because of a drug problem or whatever, and you have a drug problem again with the subsequent child, it's up to the judge whether you get a second chance or not. Just checking with the new child. And it can go either way. I've seen it go both ways.
Yeah, I certainly I worked in a hospital for a little bit, and I had seen in the maternity ward a very pregnant woman who was being walked around by a police officer, obviously was not there entirely of her own volition, and she was like, "Can I go outside and have a cigarette?" And the look on his face is like, "No." But I had an audience member write in. They knew we were having this kind of talk, and they wanted to ask a question. And I think it's very interesting because it's kind of the other side of this conversation, right? Usually we're investigating, like, parents who seem to be unfit. And they had asked, what happens when a kid calls in a false claim trying to get their parents in trouble, because they're upset or they're not getting their way? It's kind of like, that child's one chance to kind of take the power back. Is there like a special situation in that?
I think there's not a special situation. I mean, that has happened. It's very rare. a lot of times parents will say, so I've heard a lot of parents, well, go ahead and call CPS. And those times, most of the times, we kind of see through it as basically what it is. Now, of course, there could be that rare situation where the child really is, I'm finally got to my friend's cell phone to report that I'm being mistreated, and that they're jailing me are. So you can't dismiss it outright, but we kind of see through it most, what it is for what it is fairly quickly.
Yeah.
I'm going to get back to the hospital situation. If a child is born with a positive drug screen, that doesn't necessarily mean the child's removed from the parent's care. And that, I think, is a shame. I think that if a woman's using drugs and that blood, so it shows up because meth metabolizes very quickly, and that's the most common drug, but there's, of course, others, that we are doing a disservice to her if we don't take some action. But this doesn't necessarily mean you have to remove the child from her care. She can go, hopefully, to a treatment program directly, but you can file a non-detained petition. You can say, Judge, this is a very concerning situation, but if the mother agrees to go to treatment with her child, and there are places like that, then we'll just keep it as a non-detained petition. But to walk away from that situation, which some counties do, I think just it's a black eye on child welfare. What are you people thinking, that woman was using meth, during her pregnancy right up to the last minute? There's plenty of women who go suddenly, okay, I realize I'm pregnant, and then they quit using drugs. I've heard that many times, and it's good that you shouldn't use it in the first place, but still. So that's just one of my bugaboos there about the system. It's not perfect.
No, of course. And that's, that's kind of what I saw on the other side, where we were talking about, a kid potentially calling in, is it's like, on one hand, you have to take it extraordinarily seriously because, like, this is a child calling for help. And on the other side, I'm like, what do you do if it's like verifiably very false? Do you just kind of like shrug and say, like, kids will be kids? Or are you like, can we get an officer down here to explain why we shouldn't be falsely reporting crimes?
Yeah. I doubt that police officers are usually so busy that they're not going to do that.
Yeah.
And how you handle that when you find out that it's not substantiated, that's a little tricky. But yes, obviously that's dysfunction. You can probably refer the family to therapy. And yes, there are the challenging teenagers. But by and large, I know that's a parent's fear, largely unfounded.
So, I mean, last question, and this is kind of a big one. We've talked about the system, it has a lot of issues. What needs to be changed? Like, how do we go about making the right changes?
Well, I think one of the things that has happened is that there have been good progress in the changes. Like I said, that there's now these laws that if think something's really, really bad, that you don't have to offer a parent a second chance. Another improvement has been for teenagers. If a foster kid commits a crime, how do you handle that? Should it be under probation? Should it still be under child welfare? And there's now a specific procedure, at least in California, where the probation officer, or the juvenile probation officer, and the social worker write a joint report for the judge and say, we think this it should go on the probation side, or it should stay. In California, probation kids are 602s under the Welfare Institute. Kids who are victims are 300. So you kind of like figure, where are we going to meet in the middle? So that's another improvement. So I want people to know that there's been improvement in the system. When we talked a little bit about kids being placed out of state, now one of the things that's required is that the prospective relative has to complete a form that says this, they are intended to, that they want the child. I think that's a good thing. That has sped up most of the time. It still takes too long, but it is faster than it used to be. And there's procedures if the child has already lived with the relative or the child's young, that it's supposed to be expedited. That's another improvement. I think one of the things that needs to be changed is the amount of paperwork. It is replacing kids, there's always been paperwork, but it has grown exponentially. And so my complaint was that I was spending too much time in front of the computer and not enough time in front of clients. If you're having a social worker be a bureaucrat, be a data entry clerk, that's a waste of their skills, it's a waste of their time, and it's a waste of the taxpayers' dollars. So that's the one thing that's one of the reasons why I wrote my book. One was to encourage people to become foster parents. The other was to educate. And the third was to maybe move the needle a little bit about this paperwork stuff that just keeps social workers in front of their computers instead of in front of clients.
That seems almost like stereotypically government, right? Where we're like, look at all this red tape and paperwork. And you're like, yes, and it's legitimately slowing down the amount of good I can do.
Right.
So how do you make some of that change? I mean, what's the step? What can we remove?
Well, this is another thing that I would like to remove is the Indian Child Welfare Act. If a child has a Native American ancestry, the social child welfare is supposed to make active efforts to find an Indian family, presumably that matches the child's tribe. There's a history of that, that back in the 50s, a couple of hundred children were taken from Indian homes, not because of abuse or neglect. We think they're going to be better at not on the reservation kind of thing. And it was horrible, it was wrong. But then it was decades later until the Indian Child Welfare Act was passed. I think we've gotten to a better place in the world. This is the 21st century now. We're not going to have people taking away, oh, you're an Indian, we're going to take your kids. No. That's insulting to social workers. And the amount of paperwork that is necessary. If you come into court and the dad says, oh, I think I have some Cherokee ancestry. And the mom says, oh, I might have some Apache ancestry. That's eight different tribes that have to be contacted. There's three different Cherokees. There's five different Apaches. And you have to wait for them to come respond. It's just huge. And sadly, the Supreme Court just upheld it. Texas tried to challenge law. I'm not a conservative. Usually I don't agree with Texas politics too much, but in this case, I think they had a point. I think they were coming at the wrong way. I think that we don't want to treat children as chattel. That back, you know, that's, you know, used to be, you know, a man's cow, his pig, his children were his chattel. And even the king couldn't take your chattel. And that's what the tribes are saying. These are chattel. These are our children. Well, substitute chattel for children, and you've got the same thing. And I don't think that, considering the number of kids that you have to make these inquiries about, that so rarely does it come back that the child has Native American ancestry. And even if you do say, okay, the child does have some, you do the same thing that you would, common sense would do anyways. We look to family anyways. We look to match culture match anyways. Sometimes we can't do that because it's not available, but we want to do that when the situation presents itself.
Certainly try and do the best good you can with the resources you have available.
Right.
Well, Lance, thank you so much for being here. I want to make sure people can find you and your book if they're looking to find more from you.
Yes. My website is lancehilsinger.net. I have an Amazon profile. Okay. Those are probably the best two places to get a hold of me. But, well, you can't get a hold of me through Amazon, but lancehilsinger.net is the best place.
Fantastic. Well, Lance, thank you so much for being here. I have appreciated your time.
Okay, very much. Thank you.
Being a foster home must be a mix of stressful and rewarding. I'd love to have someone on who has some time in it if anyone listening wants to come on the show. In other news, April rankings have shuffled just a bit since last week. Number 1, the United States, now led by New York, California, and Illinois. Number 2, England of the United Kingdom. Number 3, Australia, with Victoria just barely staying above their southern partner. Number 4, Canada, with Ontario taking over. And number 5, Ireland, coming back strong for another month. That's it for this week. Have a great week, a great weekend, and I'll see you all back here next week for another new episode. Until that next episode, please do all those things that help the show grow, like rating, reviewing, liking, and subscribing. Remember, you can reach out to dumbenoughpodcast@gmail.com or on any of the social medias if you want to reach me personally. But most importantly, stay dumb.